Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hello people, this is Ben, this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Nice to have you along, many thanks for joining me for episode 59, which features my chat with Muir Vidler. Shall I go through the usual pre-flight announcements? Okay, what the hell. If you're a regular listener, you can support the ongoing production of this podcast by signing up for a very small monthly recurring payment, or you can make a larger one-off donation at bensmithphoto.com/a small voice. Please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. Also, I just remembered, this is important. The British Podcast Awards want to hear about the best niche podcast you listen to and why you listen to it. So please do suggest A Small Voice by emailing them at podwatch@britishpodcastawards.com. I'd be most grateful if you can find a minute to do that. Finally, if you haven't read my latest blog post, you can go to bensmithphoto.com and click on Notebook. You will find this and all other safety information in the card located in the seat pocket in front of you. So, Muir Vidler is a Scottish photographer whose work, often exploring humorous cultural and visual contradictions, straddles the increasingly blurred line between fine art and documentary. Born in Edinburgh, Muir previously worked as a chef, a street entertainer and cruise ship photographer, where he learnt the rudiments of photography and managed to save enough money to enrol in a postgraduate diploma in photojournalism at the London College of Printing. In 2001, his portrait series of ageing British rebels and mavericks, Rebels Without a Pause, was published by the Sunday Times magazine. Since then, Muir has remained in London and divides his time between commissions for magazines, corporations and record labels, and personal self-assigned projects. Muir's work has been exhibited internationally and has appeared in publications such as the New York Times, Time Magazine, Vogue and Vanity Fair. He's represented by Rove Gallery in the UK and the Mindy Solomon Gallery in the USA, and is currently working on his first photo book entitled Everything Is True. So please remain seated until the captain has switched off the fasten your seatbelt sign and enjoy the lovely dulcet Edinburgh tones of Muir Vidler.
Where I was before, it was friends and we all got on really well, and I just used to chat shit all
day. Oh mate, bring that really close to your mouth.
Here I sit and in that little corner over there with headphones on and get stuff done.
Right. You know?
These guys are all fairly industrious. So, yeah.
That's exactly the issue, and I've been through all that myself. You know, we used to have a shared office in Shoreditch, and I used to just go and socialize.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
And
yeah.
I guess it depends what kind of person you are. Some people are just can just be really focused.
Yeah, yeah.
And get stuff done.
Yeah.
And then there's those of us who just use it as an excuse to procrastinate. Oh,
exactly.
Really.
I need no distractions around me at all.
Right. Yeah. But you seem to... So you make it work in having a shared office, though. You can just get stuff done, can you?
I can get stuff done. I mean, a lot of the time... photography, like, a lot of what you have to do with photography, I think editing, retouching, all that kind of stuff, I can do with half a brain, and if you know what I mean. And I don't mean that I don't necessarily need to think about it, but I can do it with music on. I can do it with listening to podcasts. If I have to write anything,
yeah,
I have to be sitting in a quiet room, you know, or if I have to think about things in depth. But I used to have you know, the shipping container offices that you get on building sites. I used to have one of them in my back garden, which was perfect. It's a good size. It's quiet. It's got huge metal shutters on the windows, so I could keep all my equipment in there. And the only way to break into the place is to cut through it with a chainsaw, I think. But I used to sit by myself all day in there, and it would just drive me crazy after a while. So I kind of need to be out. Photography is a solitary profession to some extent, not obviously on shoots, but otherwise, you know, if you're not shooting and you have stuff to do in the office or whatever, you sit by yourself, you know. And so for me, I need to be out and need to be in a shared office, need to be around other people.
Yeah, no, exactly.
I go a bit stir crazy.
Yeah, no, I think a lot of people have the same issue.
Yeah.
Just, you know, it's just really hard to get that balance as well, whereby you've got a bit of, you're in company, but you're not being distracted by the company.
Exactly. You need the right balance, and here's a good balance. And like I say, these guys are all filmmakers. They're all doing interesting things. It's interesting to see how they work. And And
yeah, there's a certain amount of sort of creative energy as well around you, I suppose, yeah. which can have a kind of impact. It's almost you know, difficult to define it, but you know, if the other people around you are getting stuff done and being productive, then yeah. it's kind of, you feel more inclined to do that yourself, I yeah. think, anyway.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, you need a bit of that atmosphere. And like I said, the old place, I'd go in and we'd just listen to music and chat all day. And like, oh, wait a minute, I've got to do a bit of work. And then 10 minutes later, I'd be like, actually, damn, you guys ever blah, blah, blah. And then that would be it again. We'd be off.
Yeah. So, yeah. And also, I mean, I used to, frankly, to my shame, I used to kind of just use it as a place to hide. when my kid came along and, you know, it was the kind of baby phase. Yeah. You know, I mean, it was like, yeah, well, I'm just going to the office.
Yeah.
I was hiding.
Absolutely. You know. I do the same thing. It's a bolt hole. I can't do any work at home. But my girlfriend will never, I don't think, understand the concept of sitting in silence together in a room. Or if I'm in another room at the house, there'll be people, you know, coming in and chatting away and stuff like that. Two young kids I've got. So that is another thing that you're absolutely right. I wouldn't admit it to everyone, only to anyone that's listening to this, that it's a hiding place sometimes.
Yeah, of course it is.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what are you currently preoccupied with, if anything?
Just now, well, I've got a commission coming up for Stern magazine, which is a really nice job. It's shooting 5 or 6 days. I'm not sure I should say what it is, and I don't know how tightly they keep these things to the chest. Mm. But they're one of the few magazines that I work for still that give those nice jobs. I did one for them recently about Brexit. And that was a 5-day shoot. And went to Northern Ireland, to the border, went to Dover, out in the ferries and stuff like that. And it was one of those really nice shoots. It was just, they go away and shoot what you want, pretty much. And was working with Michael Schenck, one of their journalists. And he was just saying, where do you want to go? What do you want to do? And he said, why don't we go to Northern Ireland? And there's got, you know, there's the border with the EU. And so in fact, I shot, well, Peter Dench got commissioned to do it and could only shoot half the story. So then they asked me to shoot the other half. So we ended up shooting 5 days each. Sounds great for that. Mm. But the other stuff I'm preoccupied with is a book that I'm working on just now with the title, Everything is True. And that is a lot of personal work, some grants from commissions too, actually. But the loose kind of concept is contradictions, cultural contradictions and visual contradictions. And the titles are kind of rip off of the, who was it that said again? Hassan Isabai? I can't remember. Nothing is true, everything is permitted. Have you ever heard that? Which is, I think William Burroughs used it in some book or something, didn't he? So that I'm in the process of working with a designer just now. So that's taken up a lot of time.
Yeah. How long have you been in the process with that?
A while, a couple of years, I'd say. But it's one of those things that I have bursts of activity on, and then you get distracted with doing other things. I mean, you know how it is as a photographer. You suddenly get, you know, you've suddenly got lots and lots of work piled up, and you have to shoot lots of stuff and get it edited and blah blah, and then you've got to do your tax return and whatever, and then suddenly it's like that's on the back burner, and then you need to grab it onto the front burner again.
Yeah, and then it's sort of, yeah, suddenly you realize it's 6 months later or something.
Yeah,
and you
exactly
haven't done anything.
Exactly. So right now I'm it's actually all coming together now, and it's doing a book too. It's one of those things that's, I found it hard to have the breadth of vision, is that the right way of putting it, where I could look at a big project and get it and in my and have it all complete in my head. You know, it's a hard thing to work out what all the photos are going to go, what the layout's going to be like, you know, what kind of style you want it to, you know, how you want it to look like. You, I mean, you can look at through hundreds of photography books, all have completely different looks and feels and stuff like that. So it took me a while to get my head around that. And now that I do, it's coming together very nicely and it's great. I'm, like I said, working with a very good designer on it.
So, yeah, there's so many things one could talk about as far as that process goes. So you're kind of editing and sequencing. Is that basically where you are with it?
Yeah.
And so what you've got is a kind of thematic thing. It's not one piece of work, as it were. It's all kinds of different things that you're trying to pulled together as one one piece. So how are you kind of, how is that, what challenges does that present?
Well, it's a good and bad thing, I guess, because it's, you can, I mean, the theme, like I say, is contradictions. So you can be as tight or as loose with that as you want, really. And at first I was quite tight with it, thinking it has to be something that you look at and it obviously has some kind of contradiction going on, that you get what that is straight away. I mean, the most obvious one, I guess, maybe, or a obvious one, is a portrait I did of a guy called Swastika Pete, that's a black guy with a huge big swastika tattoo in his chest. Now you look at that and understand that that's a contradiction straight away. But then there's, I've got less and less focused with that idea, because I think it doesn't really matter. Essentially, it's you're throwing a title and an loose theme around a collection of work. Mm. And obviously I've shot a lot of stuff with that in mind, but I've also gone through stuff that I've shot for commissions, or I've shot this personal work that works for it, and tried to bring that together. So it's kind of, I've realized that more and more, it's just, you can be a bit more easy. You can loosen up the way that you look and think about these things.
Yeah, it's just a sort of, it gives you some kind of framework, but it can, like you say, be as loose as you like, really.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And I like the idea of doing a book too, like that. It's not just one project, you know. There's an awful lot of photography books I look at that are one project, that when I'm about a third of the way through, or half the way through, I think I get it now. You know, there's a lot of books like that. Mm. And I've had a lot of projects like that in mind in the past. Martin Osborne of Hoxton Mini Press said that to me once. I said to him, I'm thinking of doing a project, and it's kind of shooting head and shoulders shots of portraits. It's a project I'm shooting just now. I said, I'm thinking perhaps doing it for a book. And he said, don't do it like that, because it just gets boring. You see 12. Yeah. And I thought, of course, that seems so obvious now that you said it, but it's true. It's, you know, it's, and there's a lot of photography books like that. And there's very few people. I went to a big exhibition in Stockholm recently of Martin Scholler, is that how you pronounce his name? And, you know, of course, the portraits, he does the tight headshots with a very even lighting. And he's one of the very few people I see. You can walk around an exhibition with 50 photos and you really stop and look at each photo, and they've all got something interesting going on. And to use that same kind of style and lighting and technique and get something different and captivating in each picture is extremely hard. There's very few people that have pulled that off.
Yeah, absolutely. And what is it, you know, is it possible to even say how you can do that, or, you know, what is it that he can do that is so difficult? Difficult, isn't it?
I mean, my ultimate example, that's Richard Avedon with In the American West. I mean, that was one of the first photo books or projects that really got me excited about photography. And you could give a million people a white backdrop and a big camera and tell them to just drive around and get people and photograph them in front of it, and Richard Avedon will stand at a mile from all those people. And if I could explain why that was, I'd be able to do it myself.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But yeah, there's, I mean, more and more with photography, and the same with books, with art, with music, with films, I'm super impressed by people who do something very simple and make it compelling. And that's much harder to do than to do something that is technically complicated.
Absolutely, yeah. Because you've got nowhere to hide, kind of thing.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It's just, you've got to deliver without any of the kind of trickery or complexity.
Exactly, and it's like, it's what you come down to then is voice or style, perhaps. When I say style, I don't necessarily mean, what is it? We were talking before we started recording here about Nabokov, weren't we, in Lolita? And there's something he said, I can't remember the exact quote, but it boils down to basically about writing, was it's all style. And like Lolita, which is one of my favorite books, it's an amazing book, is not much happens in the plot. You know, it's a very simple plot. He abducts a young girl, basically, and they drive around motels around rural America, and that's pretty much it. But it's just his writing, and the style of the writing is absolutely, you know, totally captivating, and it's fantastic. And it's, you know, again, that's another example of that. I mean, obviously the plot of that, well, anyway, it's not much actually happens in it, but he just, over 200 pages or whatever it is, has you absolutely enthralled by it.
Yeah, I love those kind of books where it's really all about that. That just reminded me of, have you read Stoner? The guy, what's his name? John Williams or, oh God, no, I can't I don't remember think so. His name. But yeah, he's another writer like that, you know.
Okay. No, I don't think so.
So, yeah, it's funny you mentioned people like Avedon, though, because your portraiture is very much the opposite to that in a way, in the sense that, you know, you're very much a kind of, your stuff is kind of environmental portraits. You always mm-hmm. tend to use something of the, you know, space around yeah. the person. So you're kind of, funnily enough, not that kind of portrait photographer.
Yeah, it's true, I guess. And also a lot of my subjects have something interesting about them intrinsically. You know, I'll find people like a black guy with a swastika tattoo. You know, by himself, he's an interesting guy to photograph, you know. But yeah, it's true. I think I'm drawn more and more towards what that kind of style is talking about of Avedon. Like what I find myself shooting a lot these days, I'm shooting a lot these days in a Bronica SQI camera, you know, the square
one. Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. And I find myself, I didn't really plan to do this, but a lot of the personal things I'm shooting now, I'm shooting a lot of portraits that's head and shoulders with natural lights, up quite close without a lot of environment around. And it's funny because I never really planned to shoot like that. There's a personal project I'm shooting now that's portraits of people, basically, and that's what I've ended up, the way I've ended up going with it. And I'm having to force myself to think, actually step back a little bit and get a bit more environment, or I'll end up with what Martin Usborne warned against, is a bunch of photos that stylistically look the same.
Mm.
But that's, yeah, that's, I just find myself drawn to that. Steve Pike is another photographer that I've always loved, and was one of the first portrait photographers that I was really, really interested by. And he's, again, the same. And he shoots a lot like that, square format, up close, natural light.
Mm.
And he's another one. His portraits over and over again just look brilliant. And,
yeah.
And, you know, they've got something in them. It's some kind of energy. It's some kind of feel and mood to them and atmosphere to them that are, that, you know, stand out. And I've always loved that. But, and he's a great photographer, I think. Doesn't shoot much these days, unfortunately. But his, but yeah, he's, kind of, I guess I'm shooting slightly in that kind of style myself now without, like I say, really thinking about it or planning.
But is that because you're actively trying to kind of, you know, kind of expand in some way or go in a different direction? Do you find it necessary to kind of challenge yourself in that way to kind of remain creative or, I don't know, to kind of keep growing, I suppose?
Perhaps. I mean, not very consciously. Like I say, it's I should do. What you're saying makes sense. I mean, I've always liked photographers that shoot, that don't, you know, maintain one style throughout. Gareth McConnell is a friend of mine and one of my favorite photographers too. He's great. And Gareth McConnell, you look at the, you know, the stuff he's shooting now, which is all really, really weird, contrasty, bright color lighting and stuff like that, compared to what he shot 5 years ago or something like that, 10 years ago, looks completely different. But they just, it looks great. It's still his kind of photo and it's still a Gareth McConnell photo and it looks great. And he's not one of these people that's scared to, you know, to expand his repertoire in a way and to try something completely different. And that's impressive, I think. I haven't really consciously tried to do that, I don't think, though, like I say, I probably should have, or I should. But the but it's funny because I used to always shoot in that Bronica SQA. And then it's only maybe in the past year or two that I started shooting on that again a bit more. And the reason for that isn't, I mean, it's a film camera and it's not so much a big thing that I wanted to shoot on film again. So it wasn't really the fact that it was capturing an image on film that was the attraction. It was just the way they use that camera. It slows you right down.
Yeah.
And you have to stop and think. You know, when I'm shooting portraits on a digital camera, I tend to carpet bomb and then sift through the ashes. And whereas shooting on a film camera like that, you've got 12 exposures on a roll. I use the waist level viewfinder, so you have to slow right down, and you have to be exact with the focus. And
yeah, yeah. And this is quite often, it comes up a lot, really, I think, is the whole ongoing, you know, film video, film digital
yeah.
kind of question, which in some ways is kind of already pretty redundant, I think,
yeah, yeah.
as a thing. But yeah, yeah, I mean, it is much more about the process and the way in which it forces you to work
right,
rather yeah. than any kind of inherent sort of aesthetic difference.
Exactly. It's a fairly boring debate because it's all it comes down to is just how the image looks at the end of the day. And if it looks better, or if you shoot it on film and scan it and you end up with a better looking image than if you shoot on digital, great. But if you shoot better on digital and whatever, then that's cool too.
Exactly.
But yeah, like I say, it's, for me, it's just how it forces you to shoot that. It forces me to slow right down and think about what I'm doing. And that, I guess, because I've has ended up with me, like I say, shooting on these simple kind of natural light portraits, getting in a bit closer and trying to get something, a kind of atmosphere or a feeling with the person rather than looking back. I mean, if I shoot in a zoom lens, I've got, what is it, Canon 24-70 zoom lens, I end up shooting everything on 24mm. And then I look back and think, why didn't I zoom in? Why didn't I go to 50mm to shoot? And if you give me a 50mm prime, I think it's lovely. I run around and shoot everything on a 50mm. I'm going to shoot everything on a 50mm prime now. But there's something about wide angle that it's just, I end up looking at the environment and looking at people in the environment, which is great, but I don't want to shoot like that too much. And I would shoot like that too much unless I really force myself to, to put on a prime lens or a different camera or something.
But you've always, it's almost like you're using the gear that you've always used in a way. So there's a sort of element of familiarity with it and comfort with it.
Yeah.
Has it always been square format? You do a bit of everything, don't you?
Square format or 6-4-5. And now when I shoot on digital, which is, what is it, 3-2 ratio, I crop everything down to 6-4-5.
It's really weird that this has come up because it just happens to be opposite of the time. But I was curious about whether there was a square digital camera, and there really isn't. There isn't one, as far as I can tell.
I think hasn't the one that's just come out.
There might be a Hasselblad or something, which is like 50 scrillion quid or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But it's, if you want to shoot square, probably the phone. The phone is your kind of. Yeah, your first choice there.
Yeah, I know.
And that's why I like using my iPhone, because I, that's just the kind of rule that I use for myself. If I'm shooting with the phone, it's got to be square. That's it. Really? You know.
Okay.
Yeah. That's because I don't get to use that format any other way.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I kind of fell into that a little bit too. 6-4-5 I shoot because my friend Martin Salter years ago gave me a Bronica RF 6-4-5, which not many people have heard about. I don't think they made it for very long, but it's a rangefinder 6-4-5, obviously.
Really nice.
Do you know it?
Yeah.
And the neg is vertical 6-4-5 rather than horizontal.
Right.
So everything looks like the cover of a magazine when you look through it. And from my old cruise ship photographer days, I still got a Met 60 flash gun, which I still use, the exact same flash gun that I used whenever that was a few years ago. So I had that on a bracket, so the flash gun fitted above the lens, and it was turned around at 90 degrees, so the flash was portrait format rather than landscape format, if that makes sense. And so it's completely shadowless kind of lighting, and you can shoot fast on it, it's quick, it's really easy to focus. And so I've shot so much of my stuff that I like that I ended up cropping everything down to 6-4-5 if I hadn't already shot it on the 6-6 camera, you know.
I had a 6-4-5. In fact, I remember looking at that RF when I was buying one. I bought a Mamiya in the end, but great camera to work with, because you know, it's got a big neck, but you can still kind of use it like a SLR, really.
So
let's get a bit of context. I want to go back to the beginning, really, and then kind of come back to the present. So you partly grew up in California. How did that come about?
My dad grew up there. My granddad moved there when my dad was about 10. My dad grew up there until the age of about 20, moved back to Scotland, and after I was born, they moved there. But it was only to the age of 7 that I lived in San Diego. We moved back. I've still got no idea why. I still harbor some resentment to my parents. We moved back to some tiny, damp little cottage in North Berwick outside Edinburgh with no central heating and no hot water. We just had to fill the bath up with kettles.
So that's as big a contrast as you can get between that and sunny California.
Yeah, exactly. California's a great place to be a kid, especially San Diego. San Diego, I don't think it's the most interesting place in the world. It's not the most interesting place in California, but it's a great place to be a kid and just run around barefoot in shorts and stuff like that. I'm not quite sure when we moved, but then I grew up in Edinburgh. So age of 17, and then went to university in Stirling University.
And then that's where you kind of discovered photography. You weren't studying photography, but you started you discovered photo books in a way.
That's exactly how it was in Stirling University Library. I studied sociology, which was a huge waste of time. I've got a third class degree in sociology and social policy from Stirling University, which wouldn't get me a job in McDonald's, I don't think. And I couldn't tell you a single thing about anything to do with sociology these days. But so I used to sit in the library writing essays, and to avoid it, I would start looking through photography books. So the two photographers that really got me into photography was Ouija and Harry Benson. And I was thinking about this when I knew you were coming, that Ouija, you know, I hardly ever see Ouija about anyway, talked about, or his photos anywhere, anything like that. I'm not quite sure why. Maybe these kind of people just kind of come in and out of fashion a little
bit. Yeah, I think that might be it.
And Harry Benson's kind of the same, actually. Harry Benson had a really weird career as a photographer, because he started off as a news photographer for the Daily Express, wasn't it?
Yeah, his name is really familiar to me, but his work just doesn't come to mind immediately.
Well, the work of his that you would know straight away is he was the photographer on the first Beatles tour of America in 64, I think. So there's a great photo of his of the Beatles having pillow fights. And that was when they found out that they'd gone to number one in America. They just found out that second that they broke America. And weirdly enough, or coincidentally enough, my best friend at school, and still one of my best friends now, John Fyle, his dad, Andrew Fyle, was a journalist at Daily Express and was on that tour with Harry Benson. So they spent, I think, a couple of months or something like that traveling around America with the Beatles. And his dad, I remember telling to me once, I mean, Harry Benson's dined out on that for the rest of his life. You know, he owns the copyright to those photos. They've been published all around the world forever. And I don't think he would ever have needed to work the rest of his life pretty much after having all those photos, where Andrew Fyle, my friend's dad, got 20 quid a day or whatever, and that's been it. But Harry Benson, he went from being a news photographer in Britain, and then he went to America, and he ended up shooting for all sorts of Vanity Fair and stuff like that. But he's funny. He's another one. His work's kind of in and out of fashion, because a lot of his work looks quite old-fashioned and cheesy now, especially the portraits. He ended up lighting stuff all a little bit, it looks dated now, a lot of his photos. But it's more his reportage stuff looks fantastic now. He did lots of famous photos. You see like Ronald Reagan dancing with Nancy. Mm. Is it Nancy Reagan? And that look dated now and just don't look quite right anymore. But like I say, his early stuff, the Beatles and everything, was great. But my attraction to him, or what interests me about him more than anything, looking through those books, is you'd look at a collection of his work and think, this guy's had a life. He's had an interesting life. He's been all around the world. He's met some of those interesting people of our times.
Right. So when you were looking at these images, it kind of the penny dropped that this might be a kind of passport to exploring the world rather than, you know, as much as anything else.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It wasn't, you know, the art of photography that really attracted me so much. I just thought, well, this looks more interesting than sitting in a library writing essays about sociology. And that's what attracted me too. I mean, right then, my absolute goal would have been to be a newspaper photographer, and I would have been happy to work for the Edinburgh Evening News. You know, that would have been fantastic. It was that attracted me to him, absolutely. He went everywhere, and also he was a photographer at one of the most interesting times. I mean, there's a lot, it seems to me, looking back now, there's a lot more going on then than there is now. But then at the same time, Ouija's photos I love, just because it's the dark underbelly of New York, isn't it? It's just, there was just something really compelling about those, I think, too. Mm. And Ouija didn't look like he had such an interesting life, sitting in a car with his police radio on, getting the intercepting police calls and running off to murder scenes.
It was kind of ambulance chasing, kind of a thing. But the quality of those images they have something way over and beyond, you know, just what the subject matter might kind of suggest. That, you know, that there was something about him. So you went to London College of Printing, which is, you did the same course I did. You did a postgraduate course. That was quite a good year. You kind of teamed up with a bunch of other guys from that course, and I think you formed some kind of a group, didn't you?
Yeah, that's true. We formed our own little agency called Lab Photographers, which was an acronym for London, Amsterdam, Berlin, which is where we all came from. And the most well-known photographer that we were in that with was Marcus Bleasdale. So we were all, I was very lucky to be in such a good year, actually.
Who else was in the group?
There was Will Price, Karen Kakabeke, Daniel Rosenthal. I think that was it. Mm. Who are all still successful working photographers now. So that's right, there was five of us. I was very lucky to be in that year. And I look back on that now. So finished our course, we all did our final projects. I'd shot Rebels Without a Pause, which is a series of portraits of aging rebels and mavericks, old skinheads and mods and stuff like that. And Marcus shot, I think it was child soldiers in the Congo. It was something swashbuckling in the Congo anyway. And then we all went to Visa pour l'image in Perpignan and had a lot more collective energy than we would have individually, and a lot more collective clout. And we all sold our final projects to good magazines. I got mine published in Sunday Times magazine in, what was it, in Germany again? I can't remember what it was now, in Germany and Die Weltwoche in Switzerland.
So it's kind of a dream start in a way for all of you to kind of come straight from the course. And that was the kind of, certainly among people like me and possibly you, that was the big goal, was to sell magazine, you know, to get stuff published in the magazines.
Yeah, absolutely.
What was the, but you know, was there a conscious decision when you got together that it would be, that there'd be kind of strength in numbers in a way, or that you just wouldn't feel so isolated, or what was the kind of thinking?
I guess it would be strength in numbers. I mean, those other guys asked me, do you want to join? And I was like, yeah, sure. I mean, I didn't really, I didn't have any big game plan. So I guess it'd be strength in numbers, but also then, perhaps a bit more so than now, that was the thing. There was lots of little agencies, wasn't there? There was, what was the other agency? I can't remember what it was called now. But there was Network, of course. There was the NB Pictures then. But there was one agency that Simon Norfolk, Simon Roberts, Tom Craig, and who's the one that I'm missing that was the kind of leader of that kind of group, Greg Williams.
Right.
All had their agency. I can't remember what that was called now.
Yeah, there's so many that are kind of lost in the mist of time.
But if you look back at that particularly, I mean, they're all very successful and great photographers now. And you know, I think that was a big help for them too, that they were all... and then also, I mean, someone like Greg Williams is obviously a big character and had a lot of energy. And Marcus Bleasdale was the same for us, that he was, you know, the leader of that group to some extent. And he knew a lot of people. He had a lot of energy. He was charming, very successful, very good photographer. So I look back at that now and appreciate that, because I certainly rode a little bit of that wave of energy as well, I think.
Well, I guess it's also good to, when you see people, you know, how other people operate, you can learn from just, you know, observing, you know, what strengths other people have that maybe you feel like you need to work on yourself, I suppose.
Yeah. And it's like we were talking about with sharing offices too, or working in shared spaces, that it can be a slightly lonely profession, photography.
Yeah,
so
of course,
if you're sitting there with your end of year project from college thinking, right, how am I going to get this published all around the world? It'd be easy to like lose a little bit of energy. But if you go to Visa pour l'image in Perpignan with four people and you're all getting each other motivated and running around and out drinking with people in the evenings and making new friends, it's, you know, that's a very, very useful way of going about starting your career, I think.
Yeah, totally. So the Rebels Without a Pause, was that something you did after you'd finished the course?
No, that wasn't like my final project.
That was your final project.
So, as you'll remember, you'd shoot things throughout the year, and then the goal was to all do a final project. And as I remember it then, the kind of way that we looked at that was like doing it like a magazine feature, like the kind of thing that you would have published over six pages or whatever in a magazine. And that was what happened with that. The Sunday Times magazine published that over six pages. I shot portraits of all the different people and I did little interviews with them so I could use their quotes as kind of captions. And like there's, what is it, the great Stromboli, Danny Lynch, who's the fire breather, that was the kind of the opening shot that people always used of that, when the old guy blowing a huge cloud of fire and his wife's in the background going to make me a cup of tea in the house, and the kind of real suburban kind of setting. And his quote is the only one I can remember off the top of my head, which was, what is it, I've been breathing fire since the age of 20 and I'll be breathing fire after they bury me. Actually, it was a bit better than that. I can't quite remember. But anyway, it was something along those lines, just one or two line quotes. And it was just for a magazine. It was just that they'd look at that and within 10 seconds go, great, that's six pages of the magazine filled up for not much money. So it was very attractive for them, and it was great for us too. You
know? Mm. Yeah, I mean, I really want to talk to you about all that stuff, really about shooting stuff on spec for magazines. Mm-hmm. But before we get onto it, that Rebels Without a Pause, how did that come about? Was that came about from a kind of unlikely origin in a way, that story, or that the idea for that story?
Yeah, kind of. I had, the gap between Stirling University and London College of Printing was I spent a year and a half or 2 years as a cruise ship photographer. And that was from seeing an advert in the British Journal of Photography. They used to have those little classified adverts at the back.
Right.
And
but I think we all saw those.
Yeah.
So what was it about you that made you go, yeah, I'm going to actually do that? Because, well, you know,
I had little other options. I moved down to London with my girlfriend from university, and she was from London, and we shared a flat together, and we split up, and I could have gone anywhere and done anything. And like I say, what am I going to do with a third class degree in sociology?
Yeah.
So
you had the freedom.
So I had the freedom, and I answered one of those, and I thought, well, the very least you get around, you get to see a few places. And I don't know if this was lucky in retrospect or not, but it was a British guy that worked on some shitty little Greek rust bucket of a cruise ship, which weirdly enough, I met Carla Burrell the other day. She photographed me for some project she's doing, photographing people wearing her uncle's t-shirt, I think it was. And she was a crew in a cruise ship, and she said, oh, you'll never would have heard the ship I worked for. It was this shitty Greek little rust bucket cruise ship, the same cruise ship I worked on. We knew the same captain, we knew some of the same officers and things like that. And I've had a great chat with her about that. But that was, so he was a photographer. He'd been a photographer on cruise ships for years. So he had the concession on this ship. So he wanted to sit in Rhodes and drink wine and eat Kalamata olives all day. So he trained me up to be the ship's photographer and left and sat and drank wine all day. So I used to do all the, it was all commission work, was it? So we'd shoot all the work, sell all the prints. The ship got 25% or something like that. I kept 10%, he got the rest.
So you had to sell the stuff in order to earn any money, basically. Yeah,
yeah. So you'd shoot those all different setups. He trained me, I got 2 days training, and then he left me alone on the ship by myself. And that was, so you had to shoot the people as they arrived on the ship, standing next to a welcome aboard sign. They used to have the captain's cocktail party where everyone got a free cocktail. So they'd go and shake hands with the captain. You take a photo of them. That whole thing was set up just so we could take photos of them shaking hands with the captain, so you could then sell them all the prints. The captain's handshake photo was, which was commonly in cruise ship photography, that became known as the captain's cock shake. So yeah, so we'd shoot all these setups. There was a little dark room on the cruise ship. So you would go and feed the rolls of film through a mini lab, and then print them 6-4, and everything used to do 8-10, 6-8, whatever, prints through the mini lab as well. Cut them all up, they'd come out in rolls, cut them up, and then display them in the gallery, and people would come and look at them and buy their prints, all for cash. So the guy who ran the business said to me, now the cruise ship gets 25% of all this, but what we like to do, sometimes we only give them 15%, and we take the other 10%, and we stick in a drawer, and then you can pass that on to me. And I was like, okay. So I did that for a couple of weeks, and then I suddenly thought, wait a minute, this guy's got me scamming the cruise ship, giving him all the money that I'm skimming. So I kept doing that, but then I'd stick 5% in another drawer for myself somewhere. And of course, you don't pay for rent, you don't pay for food, you don't pay for accommodation, you don't pay tax. And after a year and a half of that, I had a few thousand pounds saved up, which is how I went to London College of Printing, right, and paid for the course to do that.
So yeah, it served its purpose in that respect. It was quite a useful thing to do.
And if you're 22 or something, you can do a kind of job like that now. If you gave me, if I had to do that job now, I'd have a breakdown within about 8 hours. I'd go nuts.
Well, what did you learn, either kind of photographically or otherwise, from doing it?
I still shoot like I shot then, right, all the time now. I tell you what I learned was outside bright sunlight, 100 ASA, 250 F11 with a Metz flash gun, Nikon FM2, because the flash sync speed with that is 250th of a second, whereas every other camera pretty much is 200th of a second. So that meant you could shoot on slightly lower flash power to conserve the battery. So Metz 60 CT4 flash with a Nikon FM2. And you just blitz people outside as they arrive. They'd come off the buses, and as they came on the cruise ship, you just grab them, stand them next to this life belt, welcome aboard the MS Sundream. And I still shoot like that all the time now. I go outside, and if it's a blue sky, it's 250 F11. If the bit cloud comes over, it's 250 F8. If more cloud comes over, it's 250 F6.
Right. So it's a very old school kind of, but not, you know, simple but effective.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And like you say, you still, you know, have that certain aesthetic, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, that stood you in good stead. I'm not sure how, it's almost, is it a kind of a lo-fi? How do you see it, you know, the way that you shoot with the flash? And sometimes I think, you know, it's almost like a quite a lo-fi aesthetic in the sense of how you end up wanting things to look.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, what I like about it is it's bright and punchy and right. stuff like that. And that's why you shot like that on cruise ships. You want to see them, their faces. You don't want it to be in shadow, but also you just want it like nice, bright colors.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was before I knew that there's people like Terry Richardson or whatever, they all shoot, with that direct flash look. Which, of course, I mean, that's a real school of photography, isn't it? That's a real kind of division of photography of people that shoot like that, with that shadowless, what's her name, Frederica Helwig, is it? I don't know how you pronounce her name, but that kind of thing too, where people like that shoot that kind of style. So I never knew about that at all, but I just kind of fell into that. So weirdly enough, now how I shoot, if I shoot portraits, 90% of the time I shoot on natural light, and if I shoot reportage, I often shoot on flash these days. And these days I often have the flash off camera in my hand and move it around and shoot slightly different angles. I'll hold it right next to the lens maybe, or put it off to the side. But yeah, that all comes from cruise ship.
Yeah, so you kind of learned the rudiments in a way. You learned, you know, how to expose and all those kind of...
That's the thing. Photography isn't complicated.
No.
Like I said, that guy taught me in 2 days, and I'm not a genius. I mean, I'm not very technical with photography either. I mean, there are people that do incredibly complicated lighting and are very, very creative with lots of different lighting and whatever, and that's fantastic, you know, but I've never really been drawn to that. But like I say, you can blag your way through photography with a couple of days training, you know.
It's much more about, and even so more now than ever, I think it's much more about, you know, then what are you going to actually do with it? What have you got to say? Yeah. You know, all that kind of stuff.
What do you want to shoot? What kind of people? And a lot of it's about personality, you know, especially with shooting portraits. So funnily enough, I shot the other day Hans-Ulrich Obreist, who's the creative director of the Serpentine Gallery, a Swiss guy. And we shot, and it was different for me, or unusual for me, that it was in front of a Colorama backdrop, and we had to have him talking, and then we put the photos together as a grid, four photos together for a grid. And he said to me, he gets photographed a lot, and he said to me every time he's photographed it's a different experience. And he's obviously one of these kind of guys that takes an interest in that, what's going on around him, and what kind of photo shoot's going on around him. And he said everything's different, because some people don't speak to him much at all. They just walk around him in silence. There's a slightly odd, weird kind of awkward kind of atmosphere. So other people, like me, I chat shit to people 80% of the time. When I'm doing a shoot with someone, I'm just talking, chatting away, and I think, oh, wait a minute, let's do some photos.
Yeah.
Which isn't really a kind of design. I haven't really planned that, thinking I'll do this and they'll be all relaxing, and it's just kind of what naturally happens. But that was interesting.
The point is, yeah, there is no one way of doing it. You know, there's a million different ways. So then you ended up shooting for Boys magazine.
Boys and QX magazine, exactly, and Gay Times sometimes.
Yeah, and you know, presumably you don't have to be gay to do that job, but I imagine it helps.
It helps.
And you're not gay.
I'm not gay. I would have had a lot more fun if I was gay doing that job.
These are kind of gay magazines for the kind of gay community.
Yeah.
Well, in what sense was that a hindrance that you weren't?
Not a hindrance at all, because everyone assumes you are. I mean, the only hindrance was in the office. I used to get sexually harassed in QX in the office. But I mean, that job was to go to clubs and shoot good looking men dancing around with their tops off, pretty much. But if you're in a club and it's pounding music and it's hot, everyone sees a photographer walking around and they all know you're shooting for QX magazine. So lots of guys would jump in front of the camera and say, take our photos or whatever, or you'd go up and just shoot. So everyone assumes you're working for QX magazine. I don't think no one would have known that I wasn't gay, and I don't think anyone would have cared either way anyway. They just see a camera. They don't look at and see a guy behind the camera.
So don't have the problem of trying to persuade people. It's the opposite in a way. You know, everyone's perfectly happy to get in front of the camera.
Some people, I wouldn't try and persuade somebody, but you know, in a situation like that, when it's loud music and stuff like that, you're not kind of talking to people very much anyway. People can see you, and you can tell straight away. I quite often point a camera at someone and wait a couple of seconds, and if they don't want to be photographed, they'll stick their hand up or they'll move out of their way. And if they do, they smile and throw their pecs out, which is cool. But then I shot all sorts of different clubs for that. There was, what was the really big one? There was the Astoria. The Astoria's knocked GAY. And there was all sorts, you know, Kylie Minogue used to go there, Mark Almond's. And that was huge, that club, and it was rammed. I think every Friday night, And I shot clubs like that that were full of, you know, that was just kind of really fun and just full of like mostly young men, good looking young men, right through to clubs like Fist in Imperial Gardens, which was an absolutely eye-popping hardcore sex club. And then I had to be careful what I shot in then, because there's a lot of people in Fist that didn't want to be photographed, and there was lots that did. But again, people can see you walking around with a camera, and they know if they don't want to be photographed, they can immediately communicate that, whether it's by words or actions or a movement or whatever. So yeah, clubs like that I had to be very careful with.
Yeah. What did you bring from doing that to your practice? Because there's a sense of fun, I think, in a lot of your work. So I guess, you know, when you're shooting the club scene, I mean, you know, it's people are basically having fun. And also a sort of sense of, you know, maybe people on slightly on the edges of things. Is that,
I guess,
fair enough?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's fair. One thing I've always loved about photography is you can show what's going on behind the door. And there's a lot, that's what I liked about Ouija, I guess, in retrospect, is you see all these weird little, you know, you will read about shootings or street crime or whatever, but you very rarely see photos of it, you know, and Ouija, you know, that's what I always liked about him, I guess. And it's the same, I've always loved that about photography, if you can get somewhere weird or unusual and take photos that people can see. I like that kind of photography myself, and I really like doing that. And not to say gay clubs are weird or unusual, but you don't see,
well, they're a kind of hidden world. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, if you're a gay clubber, there, you know what's going on. But if you're not, you don't really. And clubs like that, if you ever wanted to shoot in a club like Fist or what was the other one? I can't remember. But anyway, if you want to shoot in clubs like that, you wouldn't get any. If you called up and said, "Hi, I'm so-and-so from Magnum Photos and we're shooting blah, blah, blah," they won't let you in. But if you're shooting for QX, you know, you're getting to do anything. So that's a real attraction to me for photography, is you get to see what's going on yourself as a photographer in weird, unusual places, and you get to show the people. Mm. And
it's that passport thing again, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, you know, absolutely.
You're a tourist in other people's reality.
Yeah, I guess so.
The Rebels Without a Pause thing came out of that in a way, because that one of the guys that you'd kind of come across.
So
one of the characters you finally...
Exactly, Love Muscle at the Fridge in Brixton. That was the first ever... Actually, after being a cruise ship photographer, that was the first ever paid work I ever did. I can't remember how, but I got to know the manager at the Fridge. And Friday nights used to be Escape from Samsara. It was some kind of, I don't know what you'd call it. It was some kind of hippie, techno-y kind of day glow club. And then Saturday nights was Love Muscle. So he asked me to shoot a little bit of both nights. The Fridge was owned by the ex-manager of The Clash. I can't remember his name now. But anyway, so they both had me shooting in there. So I shot a bit of Love Muscle for them. And I think they just needed photos for flyers and things like that. And they paid me, I don't know, 50 quid or something. And then QX magazine published some of the photos from Love Muscle and then started asking me to shoot clubs, which was £25 a club. And I'd shoot 8-9 clubs a week, maybe. Anyway, so one of the guys I shot in... the Fridge was Adrian Del Goffi, who was a guy maybe 65 or something like that. And I got a great photo of him. I stood on a podium looking down, and he was surrounded by young, attractive guys. Then he's 65 years old in the middle, quite buff, obviously worked out a lot with tattoos at a time when people with their bodies covering tattoos was unusual. And I had a great photo of him, and he was just a really friendly guy. And I said, I mean, I almost always will say to people, let me know if you want me to send you a photo, give me your email, whatever. And we all stayed in touch, and he was a skater too. He used to skate in Brixton Skate Park. And so I took a photo of him down there, and then just off the back of that, I thought, well, that would be a nice little project to do at college if I found other people like him that are just, and that was the first idea I had too, I guess, of shooting things that were contradictory, that were contradictions in some way. So
right.
It was harder to find interesting people then than it is now with social media. That must have been in the year 2000, I guess.
But it's also a kind of an example of the kind of cross-pollination of ideas between commissioned work and personal work, which I think is what's interesting, you know, that you know, by doing commissions, things do come out of those which then turn into personal projects. I think there's a lot of photographers who've had that experience. But thinking of whether there's any other examples for you, or whether it actually sometimes works the other way. I mean, obviously, when you do personal work, you know, people see that, and then you get sometimes you get commissioned as a result of them having seen that. But I think it's happened to you a few times. Is that something that sort of you find has, you know, come up a lot?
I've got jobs off the back of doing personal work.
Well,
The other way around. I'll tell you what's... I shot, what were they called again now? There was a tribe from Papua New Guinea, an indigenous tribe from Papua New Guinea.
Oh yeah, the insect tribe.
The insect tribe, exactly. Yeah, that's right. And they were, there was a reality TV show where British people went over and lived with them. And then the follow-up TV show from that was they came and lived with a British family here. Lindsay Price, who was the photo editor at the Times magazine, the Saturday Times magazine, got me to go and shoot them living with a British family in a farmhouse in Wales. And the photo, I mean, that's one of these situations. You can't take a bad photo of that. They're wearing their kind of tribal gear. They're in a snowy farmhouse.
Totally
in Wales.
Surreal moment.
They're with a suburban British family.
Just imagining the listeners who don't know your work thinking, what the hell, you know, and obviously I hope people will go and have a look. It's mostly, well, I think everything we've talked about is on your website. It's muavidla.com, and people can see what we're talking about in all of these cases. But yeah, the Papua New Guinea tribe in the middle of a Welsh, I mean, you can't make that up.
You can't take a bad photo of that. That was a Bronica rangefinder with a Metz flash gun, and just stand there and bang. That's one reason I shoot stuff with flash. A shot like that, it's a surreal, weird little moment, and you shoot that in flash and it looks more surreal when everything's super bright.
Sort of hyper real.
Yeah, hyper real, exactly. But that the shot that I ended up, I don't think the Times magazine published it, but the one of that, it's a landscape shot of them. I think it's three of the members of the tribe stood next to the family, and she's pouring them. No, they're all drinking cups of tea, and one of the guys, the Mud Man, he was called, because that was his thing at the tribe when they had festivals. Had a muddy bag over his head, so he sent them with a cup of tea in his hand and this manky bag on his head. Chief Joe was next to him, like kind of smiling and nodding at the lady, and that I started. I got approached by an art gallery after I had photos of a project I did in death metal music in Israel, published in ID magazine. And Kenny Schachter from Rove magazine called me up and he wanted to buy one of the prints. And off the back of that, we started doing exhibitions together. And he used to show my work around art fairs, Art Basel and Art Miami and Scope, whatever. And that was one of the prints that sold the most. I was selling prints of that for £2,500. And that was to people who look at that as, and that's a work of art to them. They see that's, you know, I'm a fine art photographer, and that was a commission for the Times magazine. And I bet there's a lot of people that bought copies of those prints who would have been slightly less impressed by it and slightly less inclined to pay £2,500 if they'd known that I'd shot that off the back of a commission from... that weekend supplement.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, exactly. It's all about the context, isn't it?
A lot of photography is about perception. A lot of being a photographer is, there's some people that see you as being an art photographer and other people see you as being an editorial photographer.
But if you can somehow kind of leverage that, you know, to your own advantage, then, you know, not that we're talking about taking over the world, but you can earn a living. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's interesting that you do sell prints. And the other thing I really... you know, wanted to talk about, because it's something you've already done, or something you've always done, is, you know, shooting stories on spec for magazines, which, you know, is still possible, I guess, and it's easy to forget that. Is that something that's been generally quite successful for you? Because it is a risky thing to do, in a way. You know, you can end up out of pocket if you do that.
Sure. It's something I wouldn't do that thinking that the end result will only be selling it as a feature to magazine. I'll only do it if there's something else that I'm going to get out of that, which, for example, is selling prints of it through a gallery, or having it as in my portfolio, a website that will lead to other work.
Right. So you're looking at more. You're more looking at a kind of the wider picture.
It's got to wider picture. And in fact, often when I shoot personal stuff like that, if I get it published in a magazine, it's almost like
the cherry on the cake.
It's almost the cherry on the cake. Exactly. I mean, the last thing I did like that, I think, I'm shooting a series of portraits now on stoners, people smoking weed for various reasons. And that's, I can't really imagine that getting published in a magazine. Well, it might do. I don't know what.
Well, sort of thing a Huck would publish or something like that.
Yeah, a magazine
like
with no money. It certainly wouldn't pay back the expenses of having shot it, I don't think.
No. But that's, but you get something.
I mean, it might do. I mean, that one of the reasons I'm shooting that in America just now, like cannabis is getting legalized all around America just now. It's legalized in Canada and Portugal and all sorts of places around the world. But it's still one of those things that's slightly undercover. You see lots of photography projects about alcohol or people out drunk and whatever, and, but you don't really see anything, or I can't think I've seen much about anything to do with cannabis. And I'm not shooting that in any way to promote it or as some kind of political statement, just because it's an interesting visual subject. You've got people that smoking lots of weed and get really high and get a camera close up to the face, you get quite a good photo. Mm. And that's actually what I was thinking about when I'm shooting everything on that Bronica up quite close.
I can imagine that in the Guardian magazine or something, it has a social relevance, you know, it's not gratuitous, it's got a kind of wider context, which is that, you know, weed is socially more accessible.
Yeah, that's true. And that's another thing that I'm doing interviews with people for, because that I think is a lot more attractive to magazines if you can bring it to them and say, here's quotes from the people. And but the last thing I did like that was published by a magazine was Tomboys of Thailand, and that was, I had to go to Thailand anyway for personal reasons. Basically, I was in Thailand, and then so I had to be out there for 2 weeks, and I thought, well, I'm gonna have to find something good to shoot when I'm out there. And I can't remember where I heard about it, but tomboys in Thailand are, have you heard of that? It's the opposite of ladyboys, basically.
Yeah, I've seen it on your website.
Yeah, okay, cool. So it's women that dress and act like men. They don't consider themselves transgender, I don't think. But anyway, that's simply put, it's women who dress and act like men. And they tend to have girlfriends called Ds who tend to be very feminine and pretty and stuff like that. And again, that's another thing I think. Well, it's like I was saying, a lot of my portraits are, you try and get interesting looking people. I just thought that, well, that's going to be a nice subject for portraits. So I only found about 8 of them or something like that when I was out there, and shot again in the Bronica, mostly natural light, out and about, in the environment, out and about in time, but up quite close, actually. You know, tend to be from about half length portraits. And then I got back and Marie Claire published that. I shopped it around 5 or 6 magazines, and everyone kind of liked it. But then Marie Claire, and I can't remember how much they paid, £1,200 or something like that for it. So it covered the expenses of doing it and being out there and stuff like that. But then again, that's going to be something that I'm going to have in exhibitions. I'm going to have that in a book. There's something that it comes under that banner of contradictions that I was saying. So that's a great thing for me to have in my book.
So it's generally, although one might think it risky, the wider picture is that it's worth doing these things, even though you're going to, you know, be out of pocket in the short term, kind of thing.
And you'll be out of pocket in the short term, but hopefully the idea is that you get it published by a magazine and that pays for it. I mean, I'm never going to dine out on the profit that I make on something like that.
Sure. But yeah, I mean, even that is, you know, to what extent have things changed? Because we all know that the editorial market is, you know, a kind of mere husk, you know, of what it once was. But at the same time, nearly all of those magazines still exist.
Yeah.
And they all still get published every week, and they've all still got stuff in them. You know, they're not empty pages.
But so, they're about a third full about food these days.
Right, exactly. So that's what I was going to say, you know, in the sense of, you know, I guess the nature of the content might have changed. In terms of the photography, I mean, probably you're getting less money, I imagine.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe you're getting fewer pages, but they do still publish weird, quirky little stories or things. How does one pitch them? What are your tips on doing that? Because obviously you've had a lot of experience doing it.
Yeah. Well, I guess, I mean, I've normally pitched them to places that were, I'm already known, or I already know the people there.
Well, that was going to be my other question, really, which was about, you know, how important is it to have a relationship?
But I'll try and put a PDF together. The one bit of advice I would give to people when they're pitching stuff like that is keep your explanation for what it is very simple. Like, the photos should talk for themselves, and no one wants to read 6 paragraphs about what these photos are about or what your intention is or who the people are. And the people that are reading these kind of things and looking at them are all busy, and also you shouldn't have to explain what things are about.
Yeah, if it's going in a kind of weekend colour supplement, it needs to be, you know, immediately accessible, in the sense that it can't be something kind of obscure or opaque. It has to be like, okay, I get what that's about.
Exactly, and keep it simple. It's the same thing, I think, that with artist statements.
Oh, God. Well, that's the other side to the coin, isn't it? That's where things can get really very pretentious.
Exactly, pretentious and boring.
What were you going to say? Sorry.
No, just the same kind of thing, basically, is that, well, first of all, you know, it's, you shouldn't have to explain so much. Not necessarily because people should look at your photos and get it, but the thing is, it's all subjective. Some people might look at your photos and that you're writing an artist statement for and get something completely different to what you think about it or you understand about it, and they're not wrong. So don't, that's just the way they look at it. Don't tell people what they should be thinking, first of all. And it's pretentious and boring often. And also, it's just people don't have the time, I don't think, not necessarily the time, but the inclination just to kind of sift through, you know, your words about what things are. Keep it brief, I think. But anyway, certainly when you're pitching things to magazines like that, it really helps if people can look at it and within 30 seconds they get exactly what it is, you know?
I mean, have you sort of over the years you know, come to some understanding of what kind of stuff appeals, or is it just too broad to even be able to kind of categorize?
I'm not sure. The thing is, I mean, I've shot a lot of stuff like that in the past that I look back on now and think, you know what, that's slightly too weird or dark for a lot of magazines to publish. I mean, I shot something in Istanbul, and it was all it was a strip club in Istanbul, and then a club for transsexuals in Istanbul, and I kind of put the two things together. And I've got a lot of photos I like from that, but no one really wants to publish it. And also, when it comes to selling prints or galleries, people don't necessarily want weird stuff on their walls. They, like, you know, Scott Southern, the photographer he shot?
Yeah.
He shot all the photos of drug addict prostitutes in the 80s and 90s and stuff like that.
Yeah, you did a thing with him, right?
I did a joint exhibition with him, yeah, that's right, through the gallery. We're both represented by the same gallery in America, Mindy Solomon Gallery in Florida. And he told me that, you know, he suddenly, all these photos he shot 20 years ago, 30 years ago, were suddenly really successful or popular, or you saw them around everywhere, and they were in lots of group shows. He had a book published. He was in Vice magazine all the time. And I said to him, well, you've been doing really well recently. He goes, yeah, but I'm not making any money. He goes, no one wants to buy prints of a crackhead prostitute on the wall kind of thing. Exactly. You have to think about things like that. The people, and also magazines want to fill pages between adverts for Skodas and Hoovers, you know. You have to remember what it is, that it's,
well, that,
a business.
Yeah, and I guess that's, in a way, that's always been the case, but much less so, I think, in the past, where they were more, you know, inclined to, well, certainly back in the day, you know, things like the Sunday Times magazine, you know, famous for publishing hardcore, proper news pictures,
true.
And, you know,
yeah.
I guess there's always been that pressure. But, you know, you did the Libyan beauty pageant. You got to tell me about that, because that was just something else. Tell me about the Libyan beauty pageant story.
That was an interesting story to do. But that was, Enda Lahi was a journalist at the Sunday Times at the time. And he'd written something about, oh, this is going to happen next month or whatever. So I got in touch with him and said, I'd love to photograph this. How can we do it? Now, I think he just started working at the Sunday Times and the newspaper. And they wouldn't commission us to do it. Neither the magazine or the newspaper, but he'd been in touch with the organizer of the pageant. That, looking back, I've still got no idea what happened with that pageant, why they did it, what they're trying to achieve with it, what the motivation for doing it was. But it was a Lebanese guy who put it on. And what they did, they got a bunch of models from all around the world, chosen on their nationality to make it an international beauty pageant, flew them out to Libya, had this fake pageant, took them all to Colonel Gaddafi's house, where we all met Colonel Gaddafi, posed for a group photo with him, went to Gaddafi's son house, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, and all took photos in front of his cage in the garden with his albino tiger in a cage.
But were you sort of quietly astonished that you were getting this, you know, access to this, this kind of stuff?
I was quietly astonished. And also, the slightly weird thing about it, looking back, is, like I say, the Sunday Times wouldn't commission us to do it, but we told Omar Harfouch, his name was, I think, the organizer, that we had been commissioned by the Sunday Times magazine.
Right.
So there was a couple of moments. We were in Gaddafi's house, and Gaddafi's house, that was, it's slightly scary, visiting Colonel Gaddafi's house. You know, we were taken in cars. I went back with Enda a second time, and it was just me and him without all the contestants. And you get taken in a car, in a convoy of cars, through this huge big gate that opens up, and you go in, and then we wait around for ages with those very nervous looking men in shiny suits with big glistening mustaches. And then Gaddafi's brought out, and I was meant to be photographing a portrait from that time, but I was told not to speak to him. So he just stood there with his chin jutted out, looking a bit like Donald Trump now in retrospect, the messianic look. Well, I just walked around and took photos of him for a minute, and then I was grabbed and taken away. But there was a few moments in those situations where me and Enda would look at each other and think, no one knows we're here.
Mm.
The Sunday Times magazine don't know we're here. You know, no one knows we're here. We could get if stuck in a cellar and no one would know about it.
If you got taken
years,
out the back.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And no one would care either if we were suddenly disappeared in Tripoli. But yeah, like I say, the weird thing about that, I guess, too, is that still, I've got no idea why that happened. The British girl won the pageant, but that was only because it was British media that were there. I mean, there was no judges or anything like that. She was just told she won. And, oh God, I can't remember the name of the woman now. There was a woman from, who was a journalist at the New Yorker, and we were all flown out there on a private plane. And so we all arrived, and we'd obviously been told at customs just to be green-lighted through customs. Now, she's a well-known journalist in New Yorker, it'll come back to me, but she is American and also has an Israeli passport. So we got to customs and she gave them her Israeli passport, which caused a few raised eyebrows. Yeah. But they'd obviously been told, don't mess these guys around. So they stamped her passport and we all got taken to this hotel. And about 2 hours later, police and extremely nervous-looking men turned up and grabbed her and just took her right out of the country. She was put on the first flight.
Why didn't she use an American passport?
I think she deliberately used an Israeli one to make
just
some point.
Just to mess them.
Yeah, exactly.
Just mess with them.
Either to mess with them or so she can write something interesting in the New Yorker about the first Israeli citizen ever balled up in Libya.
Good
and got into Libya in an Israeli passport. But it only lasted about 2 hours before she was dragged out of the country again.
Wasn't there... you know, one situation where they wouldn't let you take your camera and then Gaddafi's like, why haven't you got your camera?
Exactly,
so
yeah.
It's almost like these situations where one thinks someone somewhere is in charge and you kind of realise that the lunatics are in charge of the asylum.
Exactly.
Nothing.
Well, it's like Donald Trump now. If you turn up to photograph Donald Trump, no one would really know how much time you're gonna get with him or what you're going to get to do other than him, you know. So yeah.
Which is kind of, as a photographer, is kind of what you want. You know, you want a bit of chaos. You want it to be
exactly.
Right?
Because you want your camera. That was a drawback, not having a camera. That was, that was the first thing we turned up with all with the contestants, and that's right. So we were waiting about, and just before Gaddafi came, someone came up to me and said, we have to take your camera. So we argued with him for 10 seconds and thought, well, I'm not going to win this argument. Gaddafi's own photographer was there. So he took a photo of all the girls with Gaddafi and all of us with Gaddafi and then gave us the prints. But that's right. Gaddafi at one point, we were just stood in the background and Gaddafi at one point said, someone who spoke Arabic that was with us and told me this afterwards, said to one of his guys, who are they over there? And the guy said, I don't know, I think they're photographers. And he said, well, where are their cameras? He goes, I don't know, maybe they forgot them. Gaddafi just shrugged and that was it.
They're obviously idiots.
But we went back a second time a couple of months later. And that time I was allowed in with my camera. And that was the time I was told, don't speak to him, but you can photograph him. So the guy who was there the first time we were there, Paolo Pellegrin, was there.
Oh, really?
And he was with someone, that was for the New Yorker, actually, a journalist for the New Yorker, I'm not sure who, and they were there doing a picture of him. And Gaddafi, at one point, he did have his camera, a Leica, or maybe this was, I think this is actually the second time I went back when I had my camera too. Yeah, it was. Anyway, Gaddafi was sitting in a plastic lawn chair, one of those kind of, you know, white plastic lawn chairs, and Paolo Pellegrin was allowed to photograph him for about 30 seconds, took a few photos with Gaddafi's tent in the background, and then went right up close to him, pretty much between his knees, and took one photo while Gaddafi just looked alarmed and looked down between his legs and thought, who the fuck is this? And stood up and walked away, and I thought, God, that took some nerve. And that was the front cover of it was the New York Times magazine, not New Yorker. That was the front cover of the New Yorker. It was Gaddafi. You know those photos Platon does? It was kind of like that, right from crotch level of Gaddafi with his hands on his legs, looking right down at the camera with a very serious look on his face. And it's a great picture, great cover of a magazine. Mm.
So you did actually sell that in the end. Was it the Sunday Times?
Sunday Times did publish it. Because then Ender got back and said, look at the story we've got. And they loved it and they published it. And it was a big story in the Sunday Times. And
it was worth the...
That was published all over the place. I got published in the end. And actually one of those photos... became, well, the three or four of those photos became one of the ones that I've sold lots of prints of. But one particular is we got taken out to the Sahara Desert, and Miss Croatia, I think she was, who was a really good laugh, and she was, and me, her, and Enda hung out together a lot on that shoot. And she, there was all these Libyan women that were there wearing the full-on face veils and things that stood in the, you know, in the steaming hot desert, with a Libyan guy stood behind them. And Miss Croatia was wearing a tiny little leopard skin miniskirt, and scantily clad. And we're looking at these women, and I said to one point, why don't you go and recline over there for a second? So she went over and lay down with her huge, long, bare legs out, and I took a photo, 250th of a second, F11,
with the Metz
flash, the Metz flash gun, on the Bronica, actually, with a wide angle on that time. And if I'm shooting out and about in the Bronica, there's an eye prism viewfinder I use for it sometimes. And that got published again all over, and it was sold through both art galleries a lot, and everything like that. So yeah, that was another one, I guess. That was a slight mix of editorial and personal and art photography kind of all mixed up together.
Well, I think it was interesting is you know, even if you're doing a commission, you always try and find something for yourself as well, right? I mean, is that a very kind of conscious thing for you, that you're trying to maximize or looking for the opportunities in a way?
Right, absolutely. I was looking for that, and hopefully it'll be the two things that will both go together. That magazine will like what you're shooting, and it can also, you can take it out and use it as your own personal work in a book or gallery or something. But if not, which does happen sometimes, you need to remember why you're there, that you're there because someone's paying you money to take photos to put in their magazine, and you can't fuck that up. I mean, if you work for someone regularly and they love you and you fuck up a shoot that they can't use because you've made a mistake, you're not going to work with them again.
Yeah,
there's not a huge amount of loyalty.
Not for a long time, anyway.
Or not for a long time, exactly. Not until there's a new photo editor.
Yeah.
So you have to keep that in mind, that that's why you're there. And if you can get something else, great. But, you know, you need to... I mean, if I was shooting something, I don't know, like... what did I shoot again? It was... Well, for example, if, I can't remember one off the top of my head, but if I got a job, for example, to shoot in a gay club for a magazine, they're not going to want to see something too explicit. But if I see something explicit that's gone on there and it's a great photo, then I'm going to take
it. You're going to shoot it anyway, of course. Yeah, yeah.
But you can lose focus and run around and just do that and then end up with a magazine. I'm going to, oh, I hope you're going to use lots of censorship bars here.
Yeah. What would you say your kind of strengths and weaknesses are?
I can't really admit to any weaknesses. I've never noticed any. Just getting stronger and stronger. Strengths and weaknesses. Strengths. I'm good with people. You know, if to shoot portraits, if you put me in a room with someone, I'm good with just chatting away to people, I think. And it's not necessarily to say that everyone likes me, but it can be an awkward, being photographed is a bit awkward. And if you're photographing someone who's a celebrity, they get photographed all the time. And Harry Borden said this on your podcast, and it's very true. If you're photographing a musician who's promoting a new album, they're sitting in a hotel room and they're going to get photographed eight times that day by eight different photographers. And they don't necessarily, they just want to get it over with. You know what I mean? They just want to do it as quickly and painlessly as possible. But then if you're photographing someone that isn't used to being photographed, it's an awkward thing. You know, if you point a camera at someone, you instantly don't know what muscles on your face work to make you smile or where your hands normally go or anything like that. So, and I normally, when I photograph someone, want them to look relaxed and real and want it to look like a real moment. So I tend not to direct people very much. I just tend, if you sit and if it looks comfortable in a photo, if you look comfortable how you're sitting or standing, it will look pretty good in a photo. So I tend to just chat away with people, and so hopefully that's a strength, I think, is to make people feel reasonably comfortable and relaxed. When it comes to weaknesses, I don't know, weaknesses, often I find I'll look back on a shoot afterwards and think, you know what? I got channeled in my thought process with one thing there and did that from start to beginning, went and shot not necessarily that one setup, but just that one thought of, you know, the kind of atmosphere or whatever in my mind. Whereas I could have mentally taken a step back, stopped for a second, looked around and thought, I could shoot something completely different here, you know, get a completely different moment or different focal length or different whatever. And there's sometimes when I think about that after a shoot, so perhaps that's a weakness. But mm-hmm. I once photographed a life coach, and she told me that whenever you think with regret on the alternative that you could have done, you always imagine that alternative with the best possible outcome, which it probably wouldn't have been. That alternative probably would have not been as good as you are imagining it would have been. So I could have done that alternative and think, God, I should have just stuck with what I originally started to do, you know, doing that. So I don't beat myself up about it too much, I think.
No, fair enough. Well, it's nice to end on a piece of life hack advice there from someone. Thanks, Mio. I've enjoyed it and it's been great. And I'm really, appreciative of the fact that you've taken the time to speak to me. Thank you.
I'll always find time to sit and talk about myself with someone who's interested.
Good man.
Thank you very much.
No, thank you.